Hey, y'all, and welcome to Season 2 of the Sister-in-Law Podcast. I'm your host, Charity Gates, back with another sister-in-law to introduce the audience to. This week, I have Victoria Bennett, who is a lawyer I was connected to through an alumni connection at my alma mater in the midst of the pandemic. At the time, I was looking for a full-time job at a firm, so I was doing a lot of informational calls with people whose careers I admired. Needless to say, when I was chatting with Victoria, I was fascinated with her journey growing up in the South, going to engineering school, and doing film before attending law school, to now establishing a legal career in France. Victoria's mom is also one of the first Black women lawyers where she grew up in Florida. So during our conversation, I felt like I got the in-depth foray into another sister-in-law. This episode is a bit more narrative style, so I hope you'll enjoy it. A little bit more about Victoria. Victoria Bennett specializes in global intellectual property protection, client counseling, business compliance, entertainment industry solutions, and licensing, with an emphasis on patent procurement in the United States and Europe. She is a licensed attorney in the United States and qualified to prosecute intellectual property matters with the USPTO. Prior to working in the legal field, she was an analyst engineer developing weapons, space systems, and aeronautic systems for several U.S. government contractors. She is also an accomplished film producer, having IMDb credits for short films shown at festivals around the world, as well as occasionally managing the production of commercials in the U.S. and France. She previously worked as a clinical law student in the prestigious Indie Film Clinic in New York. She has a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia, and a Juris Doctor from Yeshiva University, Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York, New York. She is admitted to practice law in California, New York, and Florida. So let's get into the episode.
Here we go. Hello, Victoria.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome to the Sisters in Law podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I love to get started with a way to get to know my guests by asking the question, what is your origin story? So where are you and your people from? And this can be as short or as long or as expansive as you want it to be. So,
okay, yeah, sure. Well, as for myself, I'm originally from Gainesville, Florida, which is in the South. It's a small college town in Central Florida that is basically like equidistant from Tallahassee, Jacksonville, Tampa, and Orlando, just right in the middle of all those. I was born in Gainesville. I stayed in Gainesville until I was 17, until I left to college. I have one older brother. He was also born and raised in Gainesville as well. And he's still there at this moment. And also my parents they're in Gainesville. They're not from Gainesville. They both went to the University of Florida. That's where they met. As in terms of my parents, my mother is African-American and she's originally from Jacksonville, Florida. And in her family, everybody is basically generations of people from Florida, from Jacksonville. They stayed in Jacksonville for quite some time, as far as I know. But then again, my mom's side family history it's not exactly clear. My mom doesn't know who her biological father is, so we're not entirely sure from that aspect. And then her biological mother, we still have some questions about exactly where her origin is, because I feel like for a lot of like Black people in the South, a lot of people are part Native American, but not entirely sure if that's completely true. So we don't know. In terms of my father is white and he came from Lubbock, Texas, a really small town in West Texas. And he's still West Texas fabulous.
all the way in Florida.
Yeah. So he basically grew up in Lubbock. Spent his summers working on the farm, and then he ended up leaving and he went to Florida because he liked all of the nature. He studied entomology for undergrad, so he studied bugs, and I know a lot of weird facts about bugs.
love for you to be on a trivia team with me if bugs were the subject.
Oh my gosh, just way too much about bugs. And he got his master's degree in zoology. He studied that at UF as well. My mother, she went to the University of Florida for law school. And so yeah, after that, she worked in Gainesville for a while as a prosecutor. She started her career as a prosecutor and as an assistant state attorney. And then she left there, she moved to Orlando. She worked as a prosecutor there. Then they didn't like it in Orlando. So they came back to Gainesville. And then my mom worked as a prosecutor for a while. Then she switched over and became a defense attorney for a while. Then she became a magistrate. She started off doing traffic court and then she did mental health court. She didn't like being a magistrate very much. She enjoyed doing the trial work. So she went back to doing defense work for felony and murder cases. And then she did that until she retired. So yeah, and then as for myself, my origin story, Gainesville was, I guess, just to kind of put it out there, like time periods of what I'm talking about. I'm 37.
Okay.
And so the time period that I grew up in Gainesville was the 90s. I was a 90s kid. Yeah, 90s is
like trendy right now.
Yes, it really is. But the 90s, it was an interesting time. Gainesville, it's a small southern town, but because I think the presence of the university there, it's always been quite progressive. It's always been kind of described as a blue dot in a sea of red when it comes to like politics in Florida. So I've been very lucky for that growing up, but still it remains that Gainesville is still a small southern town. So it was interesting growing up there because, I mean, at least with the university, they had a lot of just, I think, diversity in general, not just with race, but also with culture. The university brought a lot of people around with different backgrounds. So at least I got a lot of exposure to difference in I think in thought and culture and definitely for solving problems, just approaches, general approaches to doing that. However, you know, Gainesville could be very difficult at times because there still is a lot of intolerance there. And also in the 90s and stuff, being biracial was also very strange as well, because there wasn't a lot of biracial people. And I think for a lot of people, they didn't exactly know either what I was or how I existed in the world or where I fit in the world. I think my brother had a bit harder time with that. I think it was because, I don't know, I think part of it is because he's a boy and boys can be quite rough when they're younger, especially when things maybe make people think, make them confused or something. And as for myself, it's for the most part, I think I would just kind of ignore it. But I don't know, it didn't really start becoming either. It would become more apparent to me if people were asking me direct questions about it or they would just make some sort of a statement. You know, so, but the good thing was, at least the school that I went to was a small school, a school called P.K. Young. And it was a developmental research school, which was technically a part of the university. And P.K. is actually, it's a K through 12th grade school. And so I went to P.K. the entire time. So the great thing was, at least with P.K., is that you grew up with a lot of these people. So it's a lot easier for people to be honest with each other, because in some ways they're like your cousins. They're like extended family. So I felt like that in that respect, it was a lot easier for me to have some conversations with some of my peers to kind of understand why they were saying certain things. And to try to figure out if it was something they were asking me certain particular questions because of their own experiences, or if it was something that it was ended up learning through family. And so that was interesting, I think, as well. But for the most part, I feel like that I just kind of in general ignored that and just kind of, I don't know, just kind of existed. Yeah, it was always interesting as well, because my name is Victoria and I'm in Florida and a lot of people would think I'm Latina. And so I had a friend of mine back when I was in Atlanta asked me, she was like, well, I don't understand, you know, because you're light skinned and how do you identify as African-American? And I was just like, well, you know, for me, it's just sort of my experience. I don't know. It's hard for me to explain it because it's like the way that people interact with me when I'm out of the house, a lot of times depends on what they interpret I am. So I've had people, if they think I'm Latina, they interact with me and they assume I'm Latina. And then along with a lot of the stereotypes that go along with that, which I find to be very confusing. Or some people can, they recognize me as being biracial. Usually when I'm in Atlanta, people usually recognize me as biracial. But for example, if I'm in New York, a lot of people ask me if I'm Dominican. I get that question a lot. And yeah, and in Florida, sometimes people ask me if I'm Latina. The thing I always thought was interesting is sometimes when I'm in DC, some people think I'm Middle Eastern. I've had people ask me if I'm Moroccan, possibly. But yeah, people interact with me in a way that how they perceive me. So it's not quite clear cut. And as in terms of how I self-identify, just in general, when people do interact with me, nobody really interacts with me assuming that I am a white person. Let me put it that way. So I guess you could say I identify as like sort of a, was it ambiguous person of color in that respect. But for me, it's just more, I identify as African-American. And also by the time I'm like in school and I meet people and by the time I'm working, people know what my race is. Mm-hmm. And so they just move forward with whatever prejudices that they may have, just attaching that to me now. And usually people want to get it out of the way early if they don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, what are you? Where do you really come from? Okay. I started asking people a question. Why are you asking me that? Mm-hmm. Does that really matter? What does it mean? Like, what does it really mean to you to know what I am or what my origin is? You're not asking me that out of, I don't know, it's not relevant. So I don't know why you're bringing it up. So I've always wondered about that. And I think for people, for them, they want to know what I am so that they could know how to interact with me, which is to me ridiculous. But anyways, growing up in Gainesville was interesting because if I'm not with people who, when I'm at school or I'm with my parents, people just, they'll assume I'm biracial. Except apparently when I was very, very young, people always used to assume that my mother was my caretaker. They would think she was the nanny all the time. And they would always say,
like that.
Oh yeah, they'd stop in the grocery store. Oh, those are really pretty kids. Like, whose kids are you taking care of? She's like, they're my kids. So yeah. And I did. Oh man. I still feel like that, considering everything. Gainesville was a great, great place to be raised. I don't have really any complaints about that, actually. But it was definitely an interesting time. And well, also the other thing is, I would say, you know, the university did bring some diversity, but I wouldn't say a lot of diversity in Gainesville. However, even though there was diversity in Gainesville, I would say there wasn't a lot of socioeconomic diversity. A lot of people who were Black were impoverished. And, you know, if they did work, a lot of people worked in the service industry. And there wasn't a whole lot of people who were professionals who ran their own businesses or who were managers of places. Except, you know, some of the people who were African-American leaders in our community, and a lot of them knew each other. So through my mom, I ended up meeting a lot of people who were an inspiration to me and mentors to me, kind of helping me navigate growing up in that particular kind of situation where, you know, commercials on TV saying African-Americans can do anything, women can do anything. And then I look around and I'm like, that's not what I see in my community. And then to have the people who are leaders in my community going, you can do it. It's not going to be an easy path.
And
yeah, it's like, but you can. And then I was like, well, I don't really, you know, okay, I guess I'll take your word for it. I'll do the things that people tell me to do. Work hard in school, get good grades, do that. After that point, my mom was like, well, I think what needs to happen is we need to take a trip to Atlanta. I was like, okay. That changed things for me. That changed my perspective. I went to Atlanta. I was like, oh, wow, Black people like can own businesses and they can be managers of places and they can like drive like, you know, BMWs and stuff. And I was like, okay, this is cool. This is where I need to be. I probably should not continue to be in Gainesville while I go on my journey. So after that, I decided for several reasons, and that being one of them, to leave to go to Atlanta. So I knew I wanted to be an engineer. When I was in school, I was a tinkerer, you know, like the stereotypical kind of engineer, especially mechanical engineer. They get into everything, they break into everything, they tinker with everything. And I still remember I saved up money and I was like, I'm going to get a car for my 16th birthday. And I didn't have very much money I saved up because I was working like minimum wage jobs over the summer. I only had a couple of $1,000s. So I went to the cash car lot and I was like, well, what can I get here? Because that is your selection. Cash car lot. We We drove past all the dealerships, right, past like no Volkswagen, no Toyota, all the way in the back with like the weird sign flapping, but you know that they've been there for years. They just never got an official sign, mm-hmm, cash
almost
car lot.
Junk lot.
And so I was looking at the cars and I was like, well, kind of the newer cars, they had like really high mileage and they were just not my kind of car. And then I remember finding the car I really wanted. And it was a classic car. And I was like, I'm going to get this car. It was a 1982 280ZX Datsun. And my mom was like, well, the thing is with old cars is they break down a lot and it could be a money pit. So if you want this car and if it's not going to be a money pit, then you need to know how to fix cars. And I was like, all right. So that's what I did. And my hobby was I was just upgrading my car. And then I started getting into refurbishing classic cars. And then I was just really, and I really enjoyed doing that. From that, I knew that I wanted to do engineering and in particular mechanical engineering. So when I was looking at programs, Georgia Tech was attractive to me. Not only was a top engineering program, but Georgia Tech also touted that they were one, or I think at the time, if the top engineering school that awarded the most engineering degrees to African Americans. And I said, wow, that sounds great to me, because I would like to go to a school where there is a large community, or at least a healthy community of African Americans studying the same thing. So I said, okay, so that's going to be my spot. And I actually did a challenge at Tech. But when I did it, a challenge was a sort of like a preparation for Georgia Tech for people who were maybe not quite like ready, or they wanted to become more prepared for what the first year of Georgia Tech was going to be like. So it was really directed to minorities. And also there was a lot of athletes who did it as well.
Right.
People who are coming in as athletes. I really enjoyed it. I'm really glad I did challenge. A lot of my friends that I still keep in contact with today, I ended up meeting through challenge. And it kept, I feel like challenge actually really did keep me from really struggling in my first year at Tech. So I really enjoyed that a lot. And Tech was nice. But Tech was also, it was interesting to me. And it was a bit of a wake up call about, I guess, you know, where I was raised, the quality of my education, and what my skill set was, because Tech was such a good school and it was so competitive. They had some of the best applicants around the world. And so, some of my classmates, especially like I still remember like some of my classmates who came from India, they had like already taken like advanced calculus before they even took Calc 1. And I was like, I've never taken calculus before except the challenge. Let's see how this goes. So, but it was good. I feel like for a lot of people, you know, they get out, you know, because it's just so intense. It's so intense. But also I do remember during that time period, there was like not really any women in mechanical engineering. A lot of women were in chemistry. They were in the sciences. They were in chemistry. They were in computer science, possibly even biomedical engineering as well. But not very many women in mechanical. And I still remember being in one of the auditorium classrooms and turning around and looking around, knowing that I was only one of two women in the auditorium. And I was like, okay, so this is kind of an indication of what my industry is going to be like, which I kind of got used to being surrounded by a bunch of men. Just, you know, at Tech, it's just a lot of times that you are. A lot of your classmates and peers are men. A lot of your professors are men. I think the School of Mechanical Engineering still doesn't have any female professors. So yeah, you kind of do get used to that. And I did enjoy mechanical engineering and studying it. And Tech was a really, really great school. I really loved it. And being in Atlanta as a backdrop was fantastic. I really, really, really loved being in Atlanta as well. The thing I ended up finding out when I went out to practice is that school was very different. Academia was very different than the real world. I feel like with school, people do have a tendency to be more liberal and they have a tendency to be more progressive. Mm-hmm. And especially with my peers, it was people who were my age who were a bit more open-minded about women in particular doing math and science. So when I did go out and work, I did encounter some challenges where people just had a very difficult time trying to figure out how to work with a woman in the workplace. some of the companies, the way that they modeled their business was they had a particular profile of a person who would work there. And so there were certain things I guess they didn't take into consideration. For example, I remember at one point I was actually co-oping. This is when I was at Tech still. And I was co-oping at Toyota. And we would go work with some of their supplier plants, and they would send us out to the supplier plant to kind of see how they're doing and work with them to improve their processes and stuff. And that was fine. And I really enjoyed that. So for that particular assignment, they sent me out to kind of like the middle of nowhere. And I still remember when I was working, because my supervisors and stuff were going to meet up with me the next day. And there was somebody who came up to me off the line because I was on the manufacturing floor. And he was a nice guy. And he was like, "I just want to let you know that they still have a really active KKK in this city." And so, you know,
is this Georgia still?
No, this was in Indiana.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, I just want to let you know that. So, you know, after your supervisors and other people aren't here with you, after you go home at night and you're in your hotel, if somebody knocks on the door, don't open up the door. You know, you just need to be aware of this." And I was like, "Oh, man. Okay.
Safety warning."
Yeah. And I was like, "I appreciate you letting me know." But, you know, that's something that's like, I just want to be able to just do my job and get paid. And I don't want to have to worry about some of these other issues as well. So, yeah, I was like, you know, this is something I do have to keep in mind, especially for mechanical, because a lot of times for people who do mechanical, and I think as well as civil, they get sent out to manufacturing plants that are kind of like in the middle of nowhere, or sometimes they're working on construction projects that are in the middle of nowhere. And so I guess that was something that wasn't appealing to me, because it's not exactly, I feel like it's not to say that it's like not safe, but I'm not going to say that it is safe to work in some of those places. So yeah, after that, I was thinking, I think I'd rather work in a more urban environment than do that. So that happened. And then after I worked for Toyota, I got out of school and I worked for the Federal Aviation Administration. My government jobs are always great. And I really loved my supervisors. They were very awesome. I was sent out to Alabama on a construction project. And
these random places.
I feel like that's mechanical. So I was sitting out there, and at least it was me and a couple other people who were project managers on the site. But the thing is on the entire construction site, I was the only woman. Mm. And I was a young woman on top of that. So for me to actually do my job and tell, you know, some of the contractors, "Hey, you didn't do this right. You have to do it again, rip it out, do it again. You know, I'm not going to sign off on that for that purchase." It would be a bit difficult at times, because at least for some of these guys, I was young enough to be their daughter.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, it made it kind of a difficult task. And then on top of that, they naturally gravitated towards the other project managers on the site, because afterwards they would do stuff like go and have drinks together or go to the gym together. And so, of course, something like that, I don't necessarily think as being a female supervisor that I could actually do the same thing. So yeah, I was just like, well, this is, you know, I'm not trying. At that point in time, I was really feeling like, I'm not trying to be a pioneer here. I'm really just trying to find work and have a job that I like, and it goes well, and I get compensated for that. But I don't want it to be a job plus a lot of other things, like a lot more stress, a lot more. So I was like, okay, I need to really kind of think about this as well. And then I think I had one more engineering job after that. And that one was much, much better, because a lot of my peers and colleagues were about my age. And so I didn't have as many issues with people thinking that I wasn't up to the task, or I didn't know what I was talking about, or always questioning my judgment. But for that particular position, I was the first woman that they ever hired. At first, I remember the guy who owned the company was like, "I don't know, you know, we're going to have a woman in the mix here." But in the end, he said that he ended up liking it, because it kind of changed the dynamic in a way that he felt like was positive. One of the things he commented on is he said that, I guess he said it kind of balanced out the testosterone in there.
Oh, wow.
people became a lot more relaxed, actually, in the workplace. So I thought that was interesting. But at that point in time, I was still wanting to work in a more urban environment. I did want to make more money, which engineering wasn't quite going to offer me at that point in my career. And also, like, my dad wasn't doing well. So I was like, not for me. So I quit and I said, what am I going to do? Now, through all of this, there's another story going on too, is that my dad also, he did graphic design and he also did videography for a long time. And he had his own videography company. So I learned how to use a camera really young and editing equipment and editing on the little switchboard and stuff. So I had always done little video projects and side projects this whole time. And I've also always had a passion for film and entertainment. And I worked on some projects when I was at Tech. And then also when I got out, I worked on a few projects as well. I was thinking, well, maybe I'm going to make a switch and I'm going to go into entertainment instead of engineering. I had applied for NYU's MFA program for filmmaking and I got in, but I didn't do it because it was really expensive.
The notorious NYU prices.
Yeah, I remember I asked them, do you guys have any scholarships? And they're like, not really, not for this program.
Right.
I was like, man, I debt financed my undergraduate degree. I can't justify debt financing a master's degree in film, because if I do that, like, I mean, to me, I always felt like, you know, there's the story of the starving artist, you know, you go out and you make your art. And I was like, if I'm like super in debt, like I will have to get a job and I really will still be starving. And I was like, okay, well, this isn't going to work for me. And at that time, also, I moved up north. I was in the Northeast and I was working on, at that point in time, I was actually doing stuff a little bit more sophisticated in the entertainment industry. And I was working as like, I started off as like a production assistant and then started working on different projects as like an associate producer and stuff. And at that point in time, I had made friends with several producers and had asked, you know, kind of ran this bar in film school. And I ended up learning that there's a lot of very successful producers who were entertainment attorneys. I started off as entertainment attorneys and I said, okay, I'll think about that. When I was kind of having my moment, I was at my crossroads. I was like, it doesn't seem like peer engineering is actually going to work for me just because of the complications of just trying to do the job. And the things that I wanted as well was just, you know, a higher pay and be in a more urban environment. I was thinking, well, you know, I didn't want to do law. I actually was very like, I don't want to follow in my mom's footsteps kind of person. And I totally ate my words because I decided to go to law school.
Right. It's going to be my follow-up question because like you described your parents as having these two disparate careers. So it's like, okay, which side is she going to choose?
Yeah.
Like what inspired you to go to law school?
Yeah, that was kind of it. Because then I came to the realization, I ended up having some conversations also with people who are entertainment attorneys. And I ended up finding out more about intellectual property. And I was like, well, this actually kind of encompasses everything that I am interested in and qualified in. And I do, which is copyright and in particular copyright and patent, because I have an engineering background. Mm-hmm. And it addresses the issues that I had, which is to get paid more money and to be in an urban environment and to also be in an industry that's a bit more female friendly. Now, as in terms of friendly for minorities, at least on the patent side, they're having some issues with that still. But yeah, I felt like I was like, this looks like this could work for me. And so I was looking at different law schools and Cardozo caught my interest because I was interested in going back up to New York. That was one part of it. And the other part is Cardozo just had such a great intellectual property program. They're really well known for their IP program. So I was like, this sounds like, you know, this would work for me. I really, really loved Cardozo a lot. I just really liked the law school. I felt like that it was a smaller school. Mm-hmm. It was very intimate. They had younger professors. I felt like I was able to have a good rapport with a lot of my professors, especially in my specialized IP classes. I keep in touch with a lot of my professors still to this day. And I really enjoyed Cardozo. And I feel like the knowledge I got from just the huge amount of IP courses that they had available really prepared me working in my industry. So I really, really liked that. And then when I was at Cardozo, I did still study in entertainment and in patents. I hadn't really made a decision yet. Mm-hmm. I actually worked in the indie film clinic. I did that and I really thoroughly enjoyed that as well. And then I also took a lot of patent specialization classes. During that time, I was working as well. So my first summer, I got a fellowship to do international patent in Israel. So I went to Tel Aviv for a summer. That was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun there.
That's very adventurous to go abroad during law school.
Well, I was really looking for a job in my first summer and I was having a really difficult time. Mm-hmm. I still remember one of my friends had told me, he's like, well, I'm going to be working for this person doing international patent, but I don't know anything about patent and you do. And I told him that, you know, you're still looking for a position and I think it'd be a good fit. I got a fellowship through the school to basically pay my salary while I was there. I'm sure you could get it as well. Do you want me to put you in contact with this guy? I was like, yeah, because I need a job. So I just got really lucky in that way. But yeah, neither of my parents are Jewish. So I'll be honest, before I went to Cardozo, I didn't know much about the Jewish faith. And so I learned a lot. I learned a lot while I was at Cardozo. And so, and then, yeah, and then going to Israel too, that was a lot of fun. And that was a really great experience as well. And even with my boss that I had when I was in Israel at Stanford T. Colvin Associates, I still keep in touch with him as well. He's been a great mentor. So yeah, I did that. Then I came back. I was still kind of undecided, but I think that I did start working while I was in law school for a couple of firms. But during the semesters, I was working for a firm in Manhattan that did intellectual property. And I worked in their patent department and they gave me a lot of really great training. And it really helped me when I got my first job out of law school. Well, technically my second job out of law school. The training really helped for that as well. So I think it wasn't until I was in my last year at Cardozo, I decided to pursue patent for two main reasons. One is that the patent jobs paid more money. And the second one was that at that point in time, there was just more patent jobs available in the market. I was like, well, I guess I'll focus more on patent and see where that goes. And then maybe I can incorporate more entertainment stuff into my practice later on. I did have a bit of a difficult time at the end of law school because the firm that I had been working with, I'd worked with them for years. And at the end, they decided to not offer me a position. Instead, they offered the position to somebody else.
A fellow student or...
No, the person wasn't a student at Cardozo, but it was pretty much well known that he wasn't as qualified for the position. And I was told the reason why he got the position, I mean, it was because one of the partners in particular felt more comfortable with him because they were on a first name basis. And so he preferred to have him in the position. You know, and I just feel like, well, it's their private business. So if that's the decision that one of the partners wants to make, then I mean, that's the decision that the partner is going to make. But the issue, at least for me, is it was actually incredibly damaging for my career. It was very difficult because what ended up happening was that every time I went to an interview, they'd say, what did you do to not get the job? I mean, you were working for them. They were paying you. It looked great. You must have really messed up to not get the position. So I ended up finding a lot of people were not really considering me as being a strong candidate because of that. But the thing is that having that experience on my resume was incredibly important because it showed that I was trained. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very lucky in this respect that I had a professor that I ended up forging a good relationship with, and he was a mentor of mine. His name was Daniel Ravisher. He used to teach at Cardozo with a patent practicum class, and I did well in his class. He also was the director of the Public Patent Foundation, and they're well known because of the Myriad Genetics Supreme Court case. They were a part of that as well. But I told Professor Ravisher what was going on, and he had extended a fellowship to me to do a postgrad fellowship at his foundation, which actually was better because it was patent litigation. He was doing some really cutting edge stuff at that time. His foundation was very well known, very highly regarded at that time. So at least for me, it ended up on my resume looking like I made a strategic move in a positive direction. But yeah, I got very lucky. Yeah. And then during that time, I was able to go see some like appellate cases. And I also got to see some district court cases, like stuff I probably wouldn't have ever seen before. I got to see the inside of a courtroom, you know, when I first got out of school. So that was really awesome. And I learned a lot with that. And then after the fellowship completed, I ended up getting a position in the greater New York City area doing patent prosecution. And so that ended up being really good for me because I was able to get a very solid base doing patent prosecution work. And also I got to finally have some exposure to some trademark work, trademark prosecution, which is incredibly, I've learned if you're going to have just a generalized IP practice, it's incredibly important. A lot of people have trademark issues. So I did that for a little while. But for me, my real kind of dream was to do patent litigation. I really wanted to do that. And it was just one of those things that I knew that I was good. Mm-hmm. I knew that I'm a good litigator. And I don't know, maybe it's arrogance, confidence.
Litigator without confidence.
But I just remember I had this really weird meeting one time. I have to look it up because I could tell you who it is. I feel like the story is too important for me to not look this up, and I'm blanking on his name. I really apologize. Oh, I can't remember. But I ended up having this. My husband he's an engineer as well, actually. We met at Georgia Tech.
Okay.
And he's mechanical.
I was about to say how rare, but of course you had to have met at the same school.
Yeah. And he ended up going into this, instead of like building, construction, manufacturing, he went into design and HVAC. So while he was at a HVAC conference, I was with him. I joined him during that time period. And they were also having a conference there was like a baseball all-stars conference. And it was a lot of well-known retired baseball players who were there. Wow. I don't watch a lot of baseball. Okay. And I'm not much into baseball. So I went off to like, while he was mingling and stuff, I went off to like the hotel restaurant and sat at the bar and ordered some appetizers and stuff. And there was a guy like a couple of seats down, just kind of starting conversation with his by himself as well. So we kind of got into a conversation and I started learning a little bit more about him, that he had a couple of sons and one of his kids was an engineer. And then later on, I find out like he's an amazing baseball player, apparently. And he was like really famous. And he was talking about his journey of becoming a professional baseball player. And he was saying that he really wanted to play. He was good and he could play college ball. But for him, it was really about the position he wanted to play. He was a pitcher. And he had told me that he had a couple of offers. One of the offers would be to pitch, but he basically be kind of riding the bench a lot. And the other opportunity was with a bit more of an obscure school, but he would have the opportunity to pitch. And he had said to me, you know, I knew I was really good. I just needed to find someone who was willing to put me in the game. And I was like, yes, that's it. So I was very inspired. I thought about that. And that's the same way I felt about with litigation. You know, it's like, I know I'm good. I just need somebody to like put me in the game. But the thing is at least for, I would say for patent litigation, it is quite closed. In general, I will say, I'll be honest, I've yet to see someone who is there's been one woman I've seen who's done patent litigation and she's on the CAFC now as a judge. Kara Stoll, I think her name is, fantastic attorney. But outside of her, I haven't really seen any other women and minority women do patent litigation. So I just kind of felt like that opportunity is very difficult to achieve. So I did call several firms and through networking, I was like, what do I got to do? You know, what do I got to do to be able to do this? And they said, well, you know, you got to get a background in patent prosecution. And I did that. I went and I worked for a firm that had a good reputation for their patent prosecution. And I got that under my belt. And I said, well, what do I got to do, you know, now? And they said, well, you got to get litigation experience. And I was like, well, that's the chicken and the egg thing. How am I supposed to get litigation experience if people don't want to hire me without litigation experience? So I said, well, I brainstormed with some people and through recommendation of, I guess, some of my mentors, they're like, you may want to switch over to criminal. criminal is a lot more friendly for women and minorities to do litigation. And also because of the speedy trial requirement, you can get more litigation experience in a shorter period of time. I said, so let's do this. And so at that time, I had been trying to just switch over to criminal, which is a hard sell. You know, why criminal? Why now? You know, you do kind of the white collar patent stuff. Why do you want to switch over to the criminal world? But I got lucky and I got a fellowship with the Department of Justice. I signed up for a 6-month appointment to be an assistant U.S. attorney in D.C., which was a complete change for me. But I was excited because I found someone who was willing to put me in the game to see how I did. So that was very intense. The U.S. attorney's office was a fantastic experience. I loved it. I'm so glad I did it.
Path, it seems like one it step is. Led to another that led to a random backward step.
Yeah, for this one, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the way that they had it structured is in the very beginning, they have an intensive training period, which is amazing because you get one-on-one training with the best litigators in the country. And they give you critiques. They teach you tricks. They give you critiques. They tell you how to get better. And also, I still remember because we were like the incoming class for the assistant U.S. attorneys. And then we ended up having a day where we worked with the incoming class of the D.C. police officers. And so we had kind of like these mock trials where we were like leading the officers into the garden. And so that was a lot of fun. After that, I was in the domestic violence sex offense division. And I liked that one because I felt like that the cases could be quite complex, especially with working with witnesses, because DV to me would naturally mean you'd have a lot of hostile witnesses. And I was not proved wrong. So
that's
no,
the thing that kept me away from criminal was the the people interaction in that kind of situation.
Yeah, I gotta tell you. I mean, to be honest, like when you're talking to some of these people, you gotta realize, like if they're talking to you, it's their worst day. They don't want to talk to a prosecutor. So I really loved it because it was very different for me. Working in engineering and working in patent, I've always had just about an exception for the firm I worked for in Manhattan when I was in school. I've always had male supervisors and almost all of my colleagues have been male. But when I was in DV sex offense, my supervisor was a woman, my peers were women, and it was such a wonderful experience. I really, really enjoyed it. At first, I'll be honest, I was a little bit like, I've never worked with a lot of women before. I don't know if I'm going to be weird. I don't know if, you know, people always say things like, it's hard for women to work together for, I don't know. All of those ended up being lies. Mm-hmm. They were so not true. It was fantastic. I still remember one of the times I just remember this one day I was just having female colleagues was amazing. I remember one day I was stuck in court. I was really like, I was there and my period started. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like trial is going to start soon. And so I was able to turn to my colleague who was next to me. And I was like, do you have a tampon? She's like, I do. And I was very lucky. And I was like, wow, that's never, to me, just even that little thing, just something that subtle was amazing to me. But even outside that, just on a professional level, man, my colleagues were absolutely just quick. They're so sharp, so quick. I loved having a female supervisor a lot. I really did. Jody was fantastic. And she also had a family. So she was like, you know, she understood too, that she was like, you know, everybody's going to work hard and then people are going to go home and have family time. And it was very inspiring also to see her be able to balance those things, because a lot of times I feel like that there's pressure for women to choose, mm-hmm. you know, you choose your career or you choose your family. And I do think it's possible to do both and do both well. And I got to see an example of that, which I think is, at least for me as a professional, it's incredibly important to be able to see that and experience that firsthand. I really thoroughly enjoyed that. I felt like it was very good, at least not only did I get whipped into shape and be able to handle cases on my own and really get a good command on the rules of evidence and just feel confident in the courtroom and learn a bit more about trying to read or trying to, I guess, anticipate maybe how trials are going to go or maybe what kind of arguments opposing counsel will make. And also to understand a bit more about witnesses on the stand. You know, sometimes when you talk to people on the phone, they're very calm and they have intention to do one thing. And then sometimes when they get on the stand and they see the judge looking at them and the attorneys looking at them, they get really scared. And sometimes unpredictable things happen.
Yeah, it becomes a stage, honestly.
It does. So that was it was a great experience learning about that. And that fellowship was about 6 months long. And then after that, I was looking at, okay, you know, I got the skill set now. I'm going to go into patent litigation. It's going to be great. I have this great trial experience matched with the patent litigation experience I had when I worked with the fellowship with Ravisher. It's such a great organization. Plus the prosecution experience. Like I got it, you know. And then after that, I started looking for jobs, cold calling, meeting with people. And really the answer I kept getting over and over again is, this is great and all, but you know, we kind of have, they would say, an atmosphere, right? We have a kind of an atmosphere here. We don't necessarily know if you would fit in well with the atmosphere, and you know,
culture conversation.
Yeah. And so they, you know, I've heard, and some of them even gave me compliments. They're like, wow, this sounds like you have a great resume. It sounds like even now you have more trial experience at this point than some of the partners here. And I was like, great, then that means, you know, let's go. And they're like, no. Okay. And so I was like, well, I was still going after that and pursuing that. But also while I was in DC, I happened to go to a professional, I guess, conference. It's the AIPLA, and this is for IP. So it was really weird to kind of be in this world of criminal and then go to a conference in IP. I kind of got some distance and could see a bit more for my industry. And I was like, there's a lot of men in here. Oh, wow.
And how ironic that your experience in criminal law is more diverse.
Oh, absolutely. It was a lot more diverse. It was interesting. It's a lot of the attorneys came from diverse backgrounds, the judges from diverse backgrounds. Yeah, but for the patent industry, it really lacks in diversity. And I think that they could work a little bit harder on that. But so yeah, during that time, I still remember there's not a whole lot of women who are in patent. And some of us, we do have a tendency to connect with each other and know each other. And one of the women who was at the conference, I knew personally, and she'd been a mentor of mine for a long time, a woman by the name of Sarah Knight. She's a very talented patent prosecutor. And she had told me about, there was some sort of whiskey tasting event that wasn't on the agenda, but somebody else had scheduled it. And so she's like, you want to go? This is where the movers shakers go. And I was like, oh, I don't drink whiskey, but I will go to meet people because I'm still kind of looking for a job. Even though at that time it was at the very end of my fellowship, I was like, well, I should meet people, because while I was working for the government, you know, while you work for the government, you can't solicit employment and you shouldn't entertain anything like that. But to me, I felt like that there was nothing wrong with just networking with people. So when my fellowship ended a few months later, I could give them a call. When I went to the whiskey tasting event, I ended up having this conversation with this French guy for like half an hour or so. And we got along really, really well. He turned around and he said, hey, you know, we get along really well. I'm actually looking for an American attorney to come work for me in my office in France. I was like, oh, okay. I don't speak any French. Mm-hmm. And he had said, you know, it doesn't matter. You'll work in English. It's okay. And then at that time, there was an American who worked at that firm.
Oh, wow.
Who I'm really good friends with him still to this day. And he came over and he was like, oh, yeah, we are looking for another American. So he kind of answered some of my questions about what it would be like to work for that firm and be an American in France and what level of French I needed, if it was something that I would be interested in. And so I was like, okay, you know, that's really cool. I'll take your cards. I'll think about it. And so I go back and I tell my husband about it. He's like, no way. You got to find something that's in the US first. Like, try to exhaust that first. And I said, okay. Mm-hmm. But I started thinking about it more and more. And especially after having experience doing litigation and knowing how much energy it takes and stuff, I was like, well, a couple of things, you know, do I have to do patent litigation? Is that something that is just absolutely just something that I need to do with my life? And I was thought about it and I said, well, I think I would be equally as happy doing patent prosecution in Paris. So I don't.
What a dream job.
Yeah, dream job. I was like, I don't think I need to, you know, this, even though some of these people decided to shut the door for me, I am completely fine going in a different direction. I think I would be equally as happy and maybe arguably happier. And then also, again, the question I had was, even if I was able to convince some of these people to allow me to work in their firm, are these people that I'd want to work with? I didn't know if that would be the case. So it took some convincing with my husband. And after that, I contacted the person who'd be my future boss and we got the ball rolling. So I had to do some, initially it was a phone interview, which it was, oh my gosh. So I did not take French in high school or anything. I mean, I was in Florida, so I took Spanish. Mm-hmm. My knowledge of French was zero. My husband had taken some French courses and I remember they set up the audio meeting. And at first I was like, oh man.
That's super intimidating, an audio interview.
An audio interview. I was like, I'm going to have to be able to tell the difference between all these different people's voices. I got to remember their names, mm-hmm. pronounce them correctly. And also, if they have a really thick accent, I got to understand what they're saying. And I was like, oh man, I hope I don't embarrass myself. Mm-hmm. And I still remember for the person who was my boss, because I forgot my future boss, I forgot his first name. And my husband thought it was entertaining. He goes, how do you pronounce this name? And he just pointed to the card. And I was like, Dyer. And he was like, oh my gosh. He's like, DDA. And apparently there's a famous soccer player who has the first name DDA as well. Mm-hmm. So the phone interview went just fine. So they asked me to do an in-person interview. And so in France. So my husband happened to be going to Lyon because the company he worked for the HVAC had a headquarters that was in Europe. So I went with him to Lyon and I was like, well, I'm going to be there anyways. And I went.
Perfect.
Yeah. It was weird because I was in Paris and I've been to Paris before, but as a tourist. Mm-hmm. And I was there again, even with the meeting as a tourist, but I was trying to think like, is this the place that I can call my new home? Mm. Yeah, I was like, really like, oh, you know, I had the interview, but I was like, I did have a lot of reservations because I was like, you know, I'm in my mid 30s. Do I really want to leave my family and friends and husband to basically start over, go to a country where I'm illiterate and I don't speak the language? And then I'm going to be learning a whole new area of law because I would be learning a European patent practice, which I didn't really know anything about. And I was like, well, you know, to be honest, what are my other options? And it made me think back a bit more about, you know, sort of the history of African Americans in the U.S. who end up deciding to leave to France. It's happened a lot. I still remember during the time period when I was like looking for a patent job and, you know, people were saying stuff like, oh, well, the culture and the atmosphere. And I didn't understand. I mean, I did, but I didn't. And I still remember
language.
Yeah. But I remember going to the Air and Space Museum in DC, by the way, that's like one of my favorite museums in the country.
Engineer response or like engineer type museum.
Oh, I love it. They have like the cross sections of the jet turbines and stuff. It's fantastic. And I remember I was going through, they had an exhibit on African Americans in flight. And I still remember seeing a couple of the features that they had that were discussing. To me, it's like just the story I've heard like multiple times before about African Americans leaving the U.S. to be able to get basically a fair shake. Mm. So, you know, I ran across they had an entire feature on Bessie Coleman, and she is the first African American woman to be a licensed pilot. And so basically she couldn't get her license in the U.S. And at that point in time, African American men couldn't get their license either. And this was like in the 20s.
Right.
And so she left to France and got her pilot's license there and came back to the U.S. And then she still had some difficulty on who would recognize her license. Mm-hmm. She went back to France and then she received some training and then came back to the U.S. and she ended up doing a lot of like aeronautical acrobatics and stuff. Very fascinating. To me, it's a very fascinating story. But I still remember like some of the stories my mom would tell me, more like biographies my mom would tell me growing up, like for example, like Jesse Owens in Nazi Germany experiencing less severe racism than in the U.S. in his home country.
At the time, right.
Yeah. And so, and I even think about like even in more modern days, and the name that a lot more people know is Nina Simone, and she left to France as well. She actually ended up living in the south of France, not very far from where I live now. So I was like, you know, am I going to have to do that? You know, I thought about it. I said, am I going to have to leave America to achieve my American dream? And I think that it was heartbreaking, but I really kind of realized that the answer was yes. If I really wanted...
The first was showing you all the different stories of legacies
yeah.
ahead of you. Yeah.
And I said, well, let's take the risk. If it doesn't work out, I can go home. And if it does work out, it could be cool. And it could be something really special. But at that point in time, I knew that if I wasn't going to take that position, then I pretty much capped out, really, for my career. And I wasn't ready to be there. So I said, yeah, let's try this. And then I just remember I went through immigration stuff, going through the consulate. I went through the consulate in Miami, and they were like speaking in French, and the consulate was freaking me out there. And I was like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? And arriving in Paris with just basically a suitcase. I at least had a friend that I went to tech with. He was European. He was Romanian, and then he went to tech, and then he relocated to France. And so he at least gave me some directions on how to find the place to live, because I had made the decision that I wanted a roommate when I was first there, a roommate who's preferably spoke English and French. Mm. So I ended up finding someone. I was very lucky with that. She's very, very helpful and very welcoming. And yeah, I just showed up on this like woman's doorstep with a suitcase, like, this is my home now. So yeah, it was a very interesting time. And my boss was so great and very welcoming as well, making sure I was settling in and I wasn't having too much of a culture shock, and also giving me time to like learn my craft and also just kind of get used to being in France for the long term, and making sure that I had adequate time to be able to go through the immigration process. So that was really wonderful. And I ended up making friends with a lot of people in my neighborhood as well. I was lucky. A lot of the younger French people speak English. So I was very lucky with that. And then I started kind of trying to meet also like other minorities in France as well. Because that's one of the things that I ended up thinking that I didn't quite understand about what we kind of decide to import about French culture into the United States. A lot of times the assumption is that French people are all white. And that's not true. There are a lot of Black French people. And so when I was in Paris, I remember just, I was like, man, I'm really surprised. I'm really, really surprised that there's so many Black French people. This is great. And so I still remember, I was like, well, I would like to also try to see if I can maybe meet some other African Americans. I got on like meetup.com, and I found that there's like an English speaking meetup group to go see Hidden Figures in the theater. And I was like, yeah, this is it. It was called Black People in Paris, Hidden Figures. So I was like, I'm there.
It was perfect. Just written for you.
So I go, but there's no African Americans. It was so funny. Everybody who showed up was like, I think there was one Canadian person. I was like, okay. But everybody else who's there, they're all African or they're all French, which was great actually, because I learned a lot more French through my friendships with the squad. We roll deep when we go out. And
you had a whole community built in that setting, huh?
Oh yeah. That was like one of the number one things. I was like, my husband isn't here. I need to make some friends. But yeah, that was great as well. And I learned a bit more about sort of like French culture and history, and also French culture and history as it relates to race relationship as well, because I feel like that the dynamic is quite different than in the US. Mm-hmm. But working in France was also very interesting as well, because the way that people do work is quite different. There's more of a stress on not being stressed and having a work-life balance. And one of the things I think is quite fascinating is that French contracts are very hard to break. To get fired from a French job, they have to basically prove that you've done something to damage the business. So that being the case, a lot more people are vocal in the workplace. They will challenge ideas. They'll challenge concepts. They'll ask why. And I think that that's quite fascinating. I feel like that, at least for me, it was hard to do that in the beginning. And my boss had to tell me, he said, one of the problems I always have with Americans is you guys always say yes. Mm. You need to tell me no. Tell me that I'm wrong. And I was like, okay. So I was like,
do that. Yeah. The next question.
So, yeah, but I ended up finding that it ended up helping me become a better practitioner in that way, because I could actually explain to him, you know, I thought about this and this doesn't make sense. And, you know, why are we doing things this way? And, you know, I would think it would be a good idea to present this kind of an argument or take this kind of strategy and actually have a real discussion about it without, you know, kind of worrying that if you kind of waste somebody's time, you're asking too many questions, that they want to let you go. So that was a very fascinating difference to me. And I thought it was really cool. And I kind of in some ways do wish that in the US, they would do that as well and encourage people to ask more questions. They say that they encourage people to ask questions, but I do find that because people are so busy when you do, they're like, I don't have time for this.
Right.
I do kind of like that. At least while I was working in France, I noticed that they entertain that. And because of that, I have found that, in my opinion, a lot of my colleagues that I worked with are incredibly knowledgeable about a European practice to a level that I feel like that if I try to reach the same level of knowledge while I was in the US, it would take me maybe three times as long. And I think it's just because of the process that they're using to learn it and to really hone their technique. I did that for a while, and it was a wonderful experience. But then I decided I just wanted to have a bit more control over my workflow and also just kind of move forward in my career a bit. And so I decided to start my own practice. That was very difficult. I never would have thought that I would have just started my own company in France. But yeah, I don't know. It just naturally went in that direction. So yeah, I started my own patent practice in France that focuses on consulting on patent strategy, international patent strategy, and intellectual property strategy, as well as helping people with patent acquisition globally, but with more of a focus on the US and in Europe. I also have a US side that's based in Florida, and that side does more of the legal practice for stuff that's in copyright and in corporate. It's been interesting starting a practice. Unfortunately for me, I ended up starting my practice. I got my registration like right before COVID hit, which was very challenging.
Right.
But I was very lucky because through my network, there's been a lot of people who have been passing me clients through referrals. Mm-hmm. So that's been very good for me, kind of keeping things going. And as my practice is slowly starting to get bigger and stronger, which is nice because in the beginning, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. I hope this is going to work, especially with COVID. How are clients going to know that I exist? And so through, I guess my husband ended up helping me a lot with that because he also wasn't completely satisfied with engineering, and he did an MBA and he was in marketing. So he actually helped me some with legal marketing, at least to help people be able to see that my business does exist.
Built-in support system, literally.
Yeah, I got really, really lucky. There was that as well. And so he helped me with like SEO and stuff like that. I'm not amazing at that. I'm still not all that great with that. So that's been a really big help as well. And also for the firm that I left, my former boss had continued to give me some work as well when I first started off. So that was really nice. And I felt like that was like he was showing support for me to go off on my own. So that was really nice. So that's kind of where I am today. And I do global intellectual property. My focus also encompasses work on entertainment law as well. So I've actually been doing more and more entertainment cases lately. So that's been really cool. It's nice to be able to fold that back in.
A full 360 view.
Yeah, it has been wonderful. And then at this point in time, at least with my client base, I do serve some US-based clients, some European-based clients, but I also have a pretty healthy client base from Asia, and in particular in China. And that's been really interesting as well, that I have a lot of clients who are Chinese businesses. It's definitely been very exciting to do all this, and it's fun and exciting to do this in another country. And to start a business and run a business in another country. It's really strange. I have gotten basically what I've asked for, which is to be, I guess, in a profession that is a bit more open for women and minorities. Now, at least I have a bit more control over my workflow. I get to be in a more urban area. I enjoy that. And at this point in time, I travel. It's definitely been restricted because of COVID, but hopefully things get better. And then that I'll be able to do a little bit more traveling to work with my client bases. That's been cool. Yeah.
Yeah. You've had such a robust life, like just generally going from engineering, growing up in Gainesville, going to Atlanta and then New York. What advice would you give to someone who's looking at going into patent law and having a career in that level, especially a fellow Black woman who's interested in patent law?
I would definitely say, I think that patent is very rewarding as a practice. So I wouldn't say to be scared by the fact that there really isn't a lot of representation. Are other women or minorities in the practice? I think the practice itself is very fascinating. It's very challenging. I do like it. But that being said, it is a very difficult industry to break into. Even though there, you see, like, when you do a job search, you see all these patent jobs everywhere. It still is quite a difficult industry to get into. So my main advice would be to try to make sure that you pass the patent bar as early as you can. That'd be the first thing, because as in terms of the patent bar, it's a certification that which it really just puts you in a better position for being hired. So that would be definitely number one. And I also would say, whoever you're going to get training on, make sure that they do good work. Like, they have a good reputation in the patent community for doing good work. I would definitely do that, because then as you, I guess, continue to progress in your career, that you can build on that, and people will be able to see that and say, you know, that this person had a really good foundation. And I just kind of feel like with patent, you just want to make sure that, to make it hard for people to tell you no, to try to make sure that you have the certifications and you have training that's solid, and so that it's all there. But yeah, it is difficult in that industry. And actually, I think even at this point in time, the stuff with applying online, to be honest, I think it's a bit far for me to say it's kind of a waste of time. But because patent itself is actually quite a small industry anyways, and it can be quite insular, a good way of getting into the patent industry and getting a job in patent is by networking.
Yeah, it's relationships.
It's really about building relationships. I think for me, I've only had like one job that I got from just not knowing. No, that's not true. I don't think I've gotten any job in the patent industry without having to know somebody, except for like meeting DDA randomly at an AIPLA meeting. That was like
it was in the networking context. So you already set the stage.
But yeah, every single one was like, even if I applied online and they offered me an interview, I would reach out to my network and go, hey, who knows someone who works at this firm so that they can put a good word in for me. And so the jobs that I have gotten has been through networking and personal contacts. It's yeah. And another way that I actually ended up progressing quite far is I cold call. I am a cold caller. I feel like sometimes with the emails, sometimes they work, but I will look up somebody's profile and see if they might be somebody who would listen to me. Mm-hmm. So I try to see if they went to Georgia Tech undergrad, if they went to Cardozo Law School. I also look to see if the person is a woman, if the person is a minority. I specifically look for people who are African-American, and then I'll just cold call people. Yeah. And sometimes, because they don't recognize my number, they never pick up the phone. And sometimes they call me back. And I remember I had one person call me back, and he was a Cardozo grad. He's like, I just wanted to call you back because I never had anyone cold call before. He's like, I think that it's really interesting. He's like, we don't have any positions right now, but I think it's really cool that you did that. And I was like, okay, well, that's great. But to me, it's like, well, maybe we can get into a conversation. Maybe he has a friend that he knows at a firm that is hiring. But to be able to even just get to the point where somebody will, you can be able to interact with them is good as well. Yeah, I'm breaking into the industry and getting a job, hustling for the job is just part of it. And then there's a couple of friends of mine who used headhunters for patent. There's actually a couple of recruiting firms that actually specialize in doing patent placements. However, my experience has been, if you are not like a senior attorney, those services aren't as great because they just have so many people who don't have experience. And a lot of times the people who are turning to the recruitment firms are looking for senior level or upper management. But sometimes they can get lucky. Sometimes there's some maybe like boutique firms who use a recruiting service to look for people who are like maybe like first or second year associates. That would definitely be my advice. And try to reach out to people as well. And like I said, that there is an enormous community in patent and even smaller for women and minorities. So feel free, of course, to reach out to people who are in the industry, and they likely have a network of their own and very happy to help.
Well, I'm happy to have found you, which is very rare as well. But where do you see the future of your career heading? Like, from here, what vision for the future do you have?
At this point, that's a good question. And I think it's still kind of, I think it changes, things change in my life. So I do think at this point, I'm still going to grow my practice. And I hope that my practice ends up being able to grow and be prosperous. But of course, for me, the question is how much do I want to grow my practice? Do I want to keep it as a small practice? Or do I want to try to have a firm of my own? And at that point, I don't necessarily know what direction I want to go on with that. I don't necessarily know if I want to have a firm with a team of attorneys. So that's one thing. I kind of like the idea of being a really highly specialized attorney, like a hired gun. That appeals to me a lot, especially as I continue to get my certifications. So I'm admitted to practice before the USPTO, and I just received a positive notification saying that I'm allowed to sit for the examination so that I can become qualified to practice before the European Patent Office.
Oh, congratulations. That's major.
Until this point, I had to use people who are qualified in front of the EPO. There's not very many Americans who are able to practice before the EPO. It's really, really small community. And also, it's very difficult to be able to qualify to sit for the examination, mostly because of the rules that are implemented by the EPO. In general, they have a rule that says that your degree has to have at least 80% or more credits towards the technical courses, which in general, if your school has, they require you to take humanities courses like English composition or some sort of psychology or philosophy class, it may not allow you to sit for the examination. I got very lucky. I actually ended up having to do an appeal with the EPO because originally they didn't want to recognize my degree from Tech. And we got into a discussion on whether or not my economics courses would be considered as technical in nature, which I ended up having to do a lot of case research. I found some Board of Appeals cases that were on my side that said that courses that use applied mathematics count. So it was great because when I got the approval, it wasn't just the approval. It was a letter saying we revoke our original rejection. And that just felt so sweet.
That litigation experience came in time.
Right in time. So I do think that at this point, I'll continue to build with that and be able to also offer to my clients more of a one-stop shop for doing both US and European practice. I think that'd be fantastic. But yeah, where I see things going at this point, it still appeals to me to continue to be kind of like a very specialized hired gun rather than to have a firm at this point. But I think that could change. I do think that there is a possibility that potentially I might end up being open to taking like an in-house position at a later point. That has been coming up periodically as well. I've been working with several companies now on various like corporate and business matters, because at this point in time, now that I've had lots of experience with having a multinational company with my own, and it's kind of a long story, don't want to get into it too much, but my husband also ended up starting a company that's a multinational company that's both based in France and the US. Now people are coming to me, asking me questions on how do you create multinational companies and make sure that you're compliant with the laws in these different jurisdictions. So in that case, I am also working with now several different companies on business compliance and business needs and helping them with their expansion into different markets around the globe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm still wondering if I do want to, you know, I do like being a hired gun, but I wouldn't be surprised if later on one of these companies says, hey, we want you to be in-house counsel, or hopefully, I think a more attractive position to me would be like a CLO. Mm-hmm. I would be open to that. So that's more of the direction I think that I'm going in. It sounds like a really good trajectory. I like it. I feel good about it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yeah, I like to end the podcast with our trademark question, which is, who is your sister-in-law? And this can be any attorney who you find incredibly inspiring, a celebrity, a colleague, or someone that you knew in law school. So who would be your sister-in-law?
Well, I would have to say, I know it's like a bit corny, but I would say my mom.
I have a feeling. I was wondering if she would be it, because she sounds like an incredible person. So
yeah, very much inspiration to me. Just like, not just from like the legal standpoint, but just sort of, you know, even for just going and being a professional, her advice and her counsel, like not just legal counsel, but just like life counseling has been incredibly important to me. And her life and the things that she's been able to accomplish has been incredibly inspiring. I mean, I knew my mom was, I guess her background was quite rare. My mom grew up quite poor in Jacksonville. So like, she still talks to me about the times when like they never had indoor plumbing and they used to have like animals and stuff. And so she still remembers those days. And she's also a bit older. My parents had me when they were a little bit older. And so, you know, she still tells me stories about when she was a girl and she used to go to segregated schools and when she wasn't allowed to eat in restaurants and like what it meant to her the first time she was ever able to eat in a restaurant. And even to this day, sometimes it still makes her nervous. Like, does she still have like the right etiquette in a restaurant with her just experience of going through school and then college and then the University of Florida? And it wasn't I was in college. So there is another attorney who's also quite an inspiration to me. Her name is Phyllis Cote, and she's a professor at FIU. And Phyllis also, she worked with my mother in the state attorney's office when they were both prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And Phyllis had really done a lot in the Gainesville community. And she started off as a prosecutor, and then she became elected as a county court judge. And then she was appointed, I think she was the first African-American woman to be appointed as a circuit judge in the district that she was appointed in. Phyllis had always been an inspiration to me. And so they had the Florida Bar Association, I think it was the division for like African-American attorneys, were having a celebration for like Florida's first 200 attorneys. And I went down to Miami and I was staying with Phyllis, and she was like, "Where was your mom?" I was at the meeting. Where was she? And I was like, "What are you talking about?" She's like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about? Your mom is one of the first 200 African-American attorneys ever in the state of Florida." Wow. And she knew about it. Uh-huh. And they called her and they were going to give her an award, but you know your mom. And I was like, "What? I didn't know that." So she got out the little pamphlet and the book and she showed it to me. And I was like, "What is this?" So I called my mom and she's like, "Oh, that."
Oh, that small thing.
Yeah. Well, she was just like, "Well, you know, it's just, I'm just doing my job." And I was like, "Okay." So yeah, but my mom was just sort of like, she just really was like focusing on just doing law. And then she really wanted to do criminal law. That really was her passion. And actually, in particular, on the defense side, even though she started as a prosecutor, and I used to ask her why, and she used to say, "Because it's like I'm able to protect a lot of people who are from my community. Mm. You know, I get to actually help them and, you know, give them good counsel and help protect them from the government overreaching their power." And so for me, as I was going through my journey, trying to find my way really as a professional and getting confused every now and again when people would put up blocks and barriers and hurdles and what is this? I don't understand what's happening. She was able to give me really great advice along the way to help me kind of understand what was happening and what I could do to react to make sure that I can continue to move forward in my career. And one of the things that she used to really talk about and impress on me is just sort of this idea of to essentially not get too upset about something because it's a waste of energy. She used to call it, "It's just as good as pounding sand." That's what she used to call it. She's like, "Okay, you know, this person did this and yeah, it sucks. And they have problems with women." You know, she remembers when she was trying to get a job when she was at a law school, and there is a supervisor that she worked for who was really great and she loved him, but he had told her, "I've already hired too many women and I just can't have another woman here because you know how women can be." And she said, "You could either let that eat you up inside and get angry and try to do all these things. But to a certain degree, I mean, what good is that going to be? It's just as good as pounded sand. You're just going to have to go and you're going to have to find another way. And you're going to have to find another direction to go in to be able to keep moving to get to where you need to be." I really kind of took that in. And so for me, as I went along the way and I did encounter some of these things, I was able to go, "Okay, I can't really waste my time and energy on this." And it is kind of in a way, sort of a defeatist perspective to say, like, "I'm not going to change these people's minds." To me, it's like, it possibly their minds are going to be changed over generations. And the issue for me is timing. Timing is everything. And you need a job to be able to pay rent. You got to feed yourself. So you just got to keep it going. And then hopefully, you know, as time goes on and sentiments change and things change. And as you go along your way, you do your best to also try to make sure that the landscape has changed as well. To not just be somebody who says, you know, I want to see more women and minorities, but to actually be a sponsor and help people and hire people and employ people that are women and minorities, to make sure that the landscape is changing to look like what the rest of society looks like. I always think it's a bit weird sometimes when I will look on a website for like a really big law firm, and I'll kind of take notice. They always have people's, you know, pictures, backgrounds, names up there. And I always sometimes think it's weird that when you look at like the census for a city, and then you look at the people who are working at the firm, like they don't match at all.
Disconnect.
Absolutely. I feel like with that, like if I could either do things, either working in a law firm and trying to help people who are really trying to get a break, right? Who are women and minorities who are trying to come in as associates who can really go in there and do really great work. On the other hand, if I was somebody who was to work in house counsel, there's a friend of mine who worked in house. And one of the things that she used to do is she would ask firms for their diversity cut sheet. And if they were not hiring or retaining women and minorities, they were just not going to work with that firm anymore. And I was like, that is also a very, you know, it's a very good way of really encouraging some of these firms to maybe change the dynamic a little bit. But yeah, so I think kind of to go back to the original question, really it's my mom. My sister-in-law is my mom.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's about fighting your battles, but also like being confident in yourself. So I really appreciate you sharing that and the wisdom of your mom as well. Yeah. Well, thank you, Victoria. I appreciate you sharing your fabulous journey through the legal landscape. I mean, you've had an incredible career, and just going from different spaces, having different doors open for you. It's very exciting.
Well, thank you so much for having me and giving me an opportunity to share my experiences and stuff. To be honest, it doesn't happen that often, so...
Well, I'm glad I found you, one of those rare breeds in the patent law industry.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's conversation. As always, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review and let us know your thoughts on the episode. You can find us on social media on Instagram at Sistas in Law, on Twitter at Sistas in Law Pod, and like our Facebook page. For a full transcript of this week's episode, go to the website at www.sistasinlaw.org. If you know someone that can benefit from these episodes, feel free to share the podcast with them. Thank you for tuning in this week, and stay tuned for our next Sista in Law. Until then, peace and love.